Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Sean T. Collins. I'm a TV critic who covers Game of Thrones for Rolling Stone, Vulture, and the New York Observer, among other places and among other shows. I am the co-author of the official annotated A Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia Jr. from Westeros.org and The World of Ice and Fire, and series editor Ann Grohl for the subtext web subtext iPad app, which now no longer exists. I checked, and I have no idea where you can find this thing, but it's quite informative, I promise. And I am the founder of All Leather Must Be Boiled, a Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones website that you can find at BoiledLeather.com, which is where this podcast is hosted. And joining me, as always, is my illustrious co-host,
Stefan Sasse. I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand website, where I'm writing essays on various Song of Ice and Fire topics, and I have my own blog at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com, where I cover everything from Game of Thrones to Star Wars. And would you know it, that's the topic of our podcast today, because we both went and saw it, and I guess we want to talk about it today.
Yeah, and you know, I did think of a tangential link to A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones, which at least gives us the excuse for covering the thing in the first place.
Besides, well, I actually think there is some crossover, I think.
For sure, and besides the cast overlap, with Jojen's in there for a split second, and Brienne, you can hear her. I assume that she's under that mask, but I mean, who really knows? They could put anyone in there. It could be the dude who plays Chewbacca, for all we know. But anyway,
yeah.
But the thing that one of the things that drove me crazy was, as I left the film, I was like, you know, that bit with Kylo Ren and Han Solo, where he's like, "I really need your help," and Han Solo is like, "I'll do anything to help," and then Kylo Ren kills him because that's what he needed. That was the help that he needed. He needed him to die. I was like, where have I seen this? This is driving me crazy. It was how Shireen was killed by Stannis. Shireen was like, "I'll do anything to help you," and Stannis is like, "Really?" and lights her on fire. So there's your link, and now it's okay for us to do this podcast. It's even more directly connected to A Song of Ice and Fire than Nazi Germany. So,
yeah, even more so. How could you top this? And obviously, for all you guys, a spoiler warning for you: Han Solo dies.
Oh yeah, by the way, sorry. I guess
we'll have I guess we write it in the description. We are going to spoil the thing. No way to talk about it without discussing plot points.
Very true. So, I mean, I guess we'll just start. Well, what did you think of it, Stefan?
To give a general review, I liked it all right. I didn't think it was bad. I didn't think it was mediocre. I didn't think it was great. If I was a teacher, which it so happens I am, I would give it a B. It is very good overall, but there is one plot line in particular where I think it falls short.
I had the same basic reaction. It's funny looking online and seeing that I think most of the people that I know actually feel that way. And I was like, yeah, it was good. You know, I think that when you see people who are over the moon for it, or people who hate it, it's very bizarre
to me. Yes, absolutely.
And actually, that was my initial reaction. I've seen it now almost twice. I saw it a full time with a friend on opening night, and then I took my fiance's son to see it on Saturday, and he started getting pretty freaked out when Rey had her lightsaber vision, and then completely lost it with the confrontation with Kylo Ren and Han Solo, and then we had to leave. But I've almost seen it twice. And I remember the first time I saw it, leaving and thinking, man, I'm so glad that no one is paying me to review this thing. Because I just felt that if you leave that theater on opening day, and it's your responsibility to turn in 1,000 words about that film, you know, within the next few hours, everything you write is going to feel so overdetermined and lean way too hard in one direction or the other. Because I just, you know, it was just a movie that I felt like it's very difficult to feel that strongly about. Some of it was just because, you know, I think qualitatively that is simply the case. It's not a great film. Nor is it a bad film. Another part of it is also that there's some weird amorphous, fuzzy quality to the movie that kind of defies an instantaneous, like, it just kind of defies the usual apparatus of writing a review. I don't know how else to describe it, but, like, my buddy and I, when we left the theater, we were like, so what'd you think? And we basically had the exact same conversation that you and I are having. And we just thought, you know, there's just something missing from it. And it was so hard to articulate, I was glad I was not being paid to do so. But I'll say this for it. My primary concern was that I would be kind of viscerally repulsed by it. Because the danger of a movie like this, particularly after the prequels, which were not well received, which I'm sure we'll get into, is that it would really overcompensate by going in the direction of fan service, which I don't think it did. It's very reverent of the original trilogy, and I'm sure we'll get into that as well, because it's probably to a fault. And there's some, you know, fan service-y jokes in there and callbacks, but not to the point of distraction. And nor, you know, while it's not the classically filmed work of George Lucas in terms of editing and cinematography, it's also not like we're going to take Star Wars and we're going to make it cool, man. It's going to be like Star Wars Extreme, and it's going to be your basic run-of-the-mill contemporary post-millennial Hollywood action blockbuster. There are elements of that, but again, not to the point of distraction, not to the point where I felt like my intelligence was being insulted, or like I was, you know, like a stranger was trying to give me like some kind of Star Wars hand job under the seat, like, you know, which is good, because my concern all along had been that while George Lucas, whatever his faults, is an artist, he came up with all that shit, and he filmed it and wrote it in a way that's like impossible for anyone else to imitate. And he has a vision, and you may not like it, you know, particularly in the prequels, but it's his. And I think you can really see the contrast between that and what Abrams did. Because J.J. Abrams, I've been really hard on him historically as sort of a caretaker or a facilitator, you know, a babysitter of other people's ideas and aesthetics. And that's really true throughout his history. I mean, if you look at the dude's filmography, he's made Star Trek movies, a Mission Impossible movie. He's going to make Star Wars movies. He did Super 8, which is a straight-up Steven Spielberg pastiche. Lost was not really his idea. The germinative idea was brought to him by the network. He co-wrote the pilot and directed it and did a wonderful job. That's really one of the best hours of television, or 2 hours, depending on how you count it, I think, ever. But then after that, his involvement was extremely minimal, and everything you like or dislike about Lost was Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse. And Alias was a sexy female spy show. You know, it's just like modern day Emma Peel. His greatest claim to originality is Felicity. You know, this is not, you know, to me, it was always like, this was Hollywood adopting the creator model of superhero comics, where you have writers and artists who spend their entire decades-long careers really adding nothing, doing nothing, just working with characters created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and Chris Claremont and Frank Miller and Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster and Bob Kane and Bill Finger and so on and so on. And, you know, they're perfectly content like that. And it just, particularly when Disney purchased Star Wars and announce their plans, like, we're just going to crank this shit out forever. Like, I'll be taking my fucking grandkids to see new Star Wars movies. I was really kind of concerned. And I will say this for J.J. Abrams. Like, I felt that, you know, this film had some weird things going for it. And art always lives in the weirdness to me. And I'm just rambling on and on. I swear I'm going to turn the mic back over to you, I promise. And, you know, it's interesting because, well, I said interesting, fuck. There we go. Fans, don't let me do that. You now have permission to let me have it on Twitter. In a way, some of the best things about the film are also kind of things that are disappointing in a way. Mainly this. It's very cool to see Star Wars expressed in a contemporary cinematic idiom, to see you know, more camera motion to, you know, a more naturalistic acting, you know, things like the shaky cam shot when you're with the stormtroopers in their deployment ship and it's like Saving Private Ryan, or the shot where Poe and Finn are moving in opposite directions as the Resistance gets ready to set out for the giant Death Star planet, and they pass each other and the camera kind of swirls around Finn as he turns and looks at Poe going the other direction. It was in the commercials. Yeah,
it's such a good shot.
Right. Things like that you just don't see in the work of George Lucas, or even the work he oversaw in Empire and Jedi, because he has these like very classical, clean shot compositions. You know, it's more about panorama. It's more about placing people, you know, in kind of a flat plane within the frame. And he does the Kurosawa wipe transitions and dissolves. And, so it was very cool to see Star Wars done in a different way, but it was also kind of, I missed that. I missed the Lucas look, and, it made the film entertaining, but also less unique. Neither of which is like the final verdict about the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The fact that it does dynamic things in terms of the editing and cinematography and performance styles, that's cool, but that doesn't make it a great movie. The fact that it's doesn't have that really distinctive Star Wars look anymore, that's not cool, but that doesn't make it a bad movie. And that's kind of gets back to what we were saying. It's fine. It's a fine movie. Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily agree that it doesn't have the Star Wars look anymore, because you really can fuck up the Star Wars look. I mean, you have stormtroopers, you have a Star Destroyer, you have blasters, you have lightsabers. So every movie using that will always look like Star Wars to some degree. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be as harsh with it as you are. And I don't really miss Lucas's style, I have to say. I'm not such a big, how do you say, film history nerd in that respect. So I really liked the more dynamic shots, especially if you compare it to the prequels, which were really boring in the shot compositions, which has been a constant criticism for them. You know, all those dialogues of people sitting down on a couch. And so that I liked. To get into your point about the weirdness, this is the one point where I especially like the movie, and most pronounced in the figure of Kylo Ren.
Yeah.
I think, as far as I can see from the internet discussion that I am following, he's kind of a bit of a polarizing figure, not by a large degree, but there are the most strong opinions are mostly about Kylo Ren. You know, does he work as a villain or not? And I think what Abrams has done here is pretty genius. It's the one one creative stroke in the movie that I really think is creative, you know,
where he really
tried something new. The rest you can argue is point by numbers, but Kylo Ren is just weird. And when the movie ended and I went out with my buddies and we walked back to the train, and I said to the guy walking next to me, you know what? I had this feeling that Abrams at some point was just trolling George Lucas, you know, because so many of these scenes had a giant sign painted over them. Look, that's how it's done, you know, because they all addressed those issues that fans had with the prequels and simply did them better. For example, Kylo Ren is just Anakin, but done much better than Christensen's dialogue. Mm-hmm. And the space battles were better executed and all that kind of stuff. But it, especially with Kylo Ren as an Anakin version, I think it became the most clear to me that this was really the same story once again, because, you know, everything rhymes, blah, blah, blah. What Lucas already said, the circular structure of Star Wars movies, you can already see the beginnings of it here. And it worked extremely well for me, because Kylo Ren is subverting all expectations you have for a Sith Lord. He's whiny. His face is nothing like it should be. His hairdress is nothing like it should be. I mean, everything about him runs contrary to your expectations. He is not really good at what he's doing. In the beginning, he comes off as competent because he can stop a blaster shot midair. But he really sucks at reading people's minds if they pose the minimum resistance, and he's horrible with a lightsaber. So I really like these ideas, you know, presenting them with this untrained, strange guy that has just been thrown in the mix, who is an artificial element even on Starkiller base, and constantly griping with Admiral Hux. I thought this was a really good idea. And from there, going on from there, I think that the major story beats in relationship to the characters work very well. Daisy Ridley is great as Rey. The Finn character is really good. Poe is really good. All of those characters work. I think Han Solo's arc works very good. The one thing that didn't work, didn't involve character, which was the Starkiller base. I really didn't think that this was a good idea.
I agree with you. And you've just given us a whole lot to tack on. I'll try and take it point by point. But yeah, it's exactly like you said. When I mentioned the word weirdness, it was Kylo Ren that I was thinking of. That's a really, really compelling character. And even though, like you said, we're basically looking at Anakin Skywalker 2.0, it still felt very different because of the position of power he was in. When Anakin is being his whiny asshole, like, early Sith self, he's very much still the under the gun, you know, under the thumb of Palpatine. You know, he's still kind of feeling things out. And this is like if he had just fucking put on the mask right away and was like, I'm a horrible person. I'm going for it, you know. It took him a while to get there. He didn't even really get there in the prequels. You know, his first thought when he puts the mask, when the mask goes on him, is where's Padme or whatever. So it's seeing, you know, it has those elements, but it's taking them in a new direction, doing a new thing with them.
I also like this, I am tempted by the light side. Yeah. I want to be bad. I want to be Darth Vader. I want it so bad. Why can't I be Darth Vader? And I thought this was really a great idea.
I'm so psyched to read that in your review, because I thought that was really insightful and a really good way to use the metaphor of the Force as an illustration of how conscience works, how you want... Conscience is often a drag, you know? It's the part of you where you want to do something bad. Being tempted by the light side is a really good way to describe your conscience in certain circumstances. Where, you know, all your plans hinge on doing something shitty, and all your desires hinge on doing something shitty. But there's this part of you that's like calling to you and saying, it's not like waving its finger at you like an angry parent or like the angel on your shoulder or whatever. Like there's something satisfying about doing the right thing that sometimes you need to try and reject to get what you want. And that was really, I thought that was a super insightful point, Stefan, right on. And the thing that I really want to single out about Kylo Ren is the performance. And here's where The Force Awakens is really blessed. In the person of Adam Driver, who plays Kylo Ren, and Oscar Isaac, who plays Poe Dameron, they've got maybe the two best actors of their generation in a Star Wars movie, which is super cool. And I made a joke a long time ago that it would be cool if Adam Driver played kind of like a Sith Lord in the style that he plays Lena Dunham's boyfriend on the show Girls, because his line readings on that show are like so weird. Like, he's always feels like, I don't fucking know, Hannah. And he's all freaking out and he's tense and weird and making grunty animal noises and like he can barely control his emotions. And then lo and behold, that's pretty much exactly what we got. And he made it. It didn't feel like stupid and out of place. He really made that work for the character, and it helped you understand who that character was and where he was at in his life. And I was just so impressed by that. And I think, I'm trying to think what else you mentioned. You mentioned Starkiller Base, and we'll get to that. But one thing, this is a point I wanted to raise. any discussion of these characters as mere archetypes ignores the strength of the acting, which is just very good in basically every role. I wasn't nuts about Carrie Fisher, I hate to say it. But in every other major speaking part, all these people are so much fun to watch on screen. Like, you want to see more of them. Daisy Ridley, John Boyega, Adam Driver, Oscar Isaac. So when people complain that Poe Dameron has no arc, when people complain that Rey is a Mary Sue, listen, I happen to believe that both those things are true, but I also happen to believe that that's not the final verdict on either of these people, because it ignores their presence on screen. It ignores whether they're fucking just fun to watch, and they are, because they're good actors, and the dialogue is tight and funny and well-written, and it just works. You know, I agree that she's a Mary Sue. She's perfect, basically fresh out of the box. The only fault that she has is that she misses her parents. And in fact, there was something I wanted to read, if that's okay. Let's see. It was a review that Tasha Robinson wrote for The Verge, and there's a passage that was quoted on IndieWire, which is where I saw it. And she says, you know, let's face it, Rey is kind of a Mary Sue character. That's fan speak for a thinly veiled self-insertion character in fan fiction, usually written by someone who wants not just to be part of an imaginary world they love, but to be its ultimate, most beloved, and respected hero. The male version is a Gary Stu. Rey is a survivor who seems to be consummately skilled at everything she tries. She's a crack pilot. She's a skilled mechanic. She's so innately talented in her use of the Force that she figures out Jedi mind tricks on her own out of nowhere. She keeps falling into standard-issue damsel-in-distress situations, then capably rescuing herself. Even Han Solo is vocally and visibly impressed with her awesomeness. Her only weakness is a minor and understandable one. She misses her parents. The parents who seemingly abandon her. And this is, like, verbatim something I wrote in an email to my friends the day, you know, the day after the movie. But the article goes on to basically be like, so what? Who cares? And it maybe goes a little further than I would in kind of saying that this is, like, it's great for women to have characters like this, which is like, well, yeah, I guess that's true, but are we looking for balance in the Force? Are we looking for actual progress? And I'm not convinced this is actual progress. The point is just this. You can say it's a Mary Sue and not be a sexist pig, and not, because it's a Mary Sue. But you can also say it's a Mary Sue and not throw the movie out the window, because it doesn't ruin the movie. It just doesn't.
No, not at all. I think if you go on like this, you can also say that John Boyega is an affirmative action stormtrooper, but so what? It was past time that a woman character is in Star Wars and is doing something. And it is past time that there was some diversity in the male cast. So kudos, I guess, to bring in a black guy, a woman, and I don't know, is Isaac something like Hispanic? He is, at least. He's a bit like it.
Yeah.
So, that was really, it was needed. And the way the movie goes about it, like, it's no deal whatsoever. It's just what the doctor ordered. So I'm absolutely for this. Mm-hmm. And I want to expand your point about that we have no final verdict yet on the question of whether or not these arcs are complete. Because, and this goes into the direction that this movie is basically Star Wars A New Hope 2.0.
Yeah.
Because it is the first movie in a trilogy. And the contrary to other trilogies I could name, this one really tries to be a trilogy. You know?
Yeah.
What we get here is the groundwork. And we don't know yet where these characters are going to go. And what I'm trying to tell people all the time, think of Star Wars, the first movie, as only Star Wars, the first movie. So much stuff doesn't get explained in the first movie. The Republic, I have no idea. Who is Darth Vader other than a guy in a dark suit? I don't know. And so on and so forth. All of this is only explained in the later movies. So I guess this is what they're going to do with this one too. So what was Han Solo up to until now? I have no clue. Does it matter? No. This is true for a lot of this stuff. You know, those arcs that they are having or not having are only just beginning. And the movie is clearly about Rey. as was the first movie about Luke, and all the other guys are supporting cast. I mean, Finn gets a pretty big role, but he's still supporting cast, basically. He's more or less what Han Solo was in the first movie, and Han Solo, he did one selfless act in the end, and that was his arc, you know? And there wasn't that much development. Complaining that Poe doesn't get one is like complaining that Chewbacca doesn't get an arc in the first movie. Of course he doesn't.
Right, right. Well,
he's not there for that.
Yeah. I would say the big difference, I actually do think Finn is a protagonist, and I think one structural thing you can point to make that argument is that Han Solo, we meet through Luke. We meet everybody through Luke except the droids, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. I just rewatched the first one and noticed that the droids get their own introduction. Like the droids, Finn has the droids role in the beginning of the film, which is nuts. But everybody else, you meet Obi-Wan through Luke, you meet Han through Luke, you know, and so on. Finn and Rey get kind of parallel, separate introductions, which to me puts them on a similar level. But other than that, and then the other big difference structurally is this goes right into a cliffhanger. Phantom Menace and A New Hope both end on like an unambiguously celebratory note. Now, Phantom Menace is complicated by the fact that you know that Senator Palpatine is actually the Emperor and he's up to no good, but you know, it's much more of a just like, hooray, we did it. And this has this whole thing where she goes and we don't know if Luke takes the lightsaber from her, and that's a bit different too. Other than that, this is like a facsimile of A New Hope. You know, you got a chosen one, a rogue, a droid, a Wookiee, a cool old man. They have plans for a secret base that they need to get to a bunch of good guys. I mean, it ends with a duel with a Dark Lord in a black mask. I mean, it's such a clone, no pun intended, of the first film that it's almost, you know, it's kind of shocking how little an effort they made to do anything. They even have like a British fascist, you know, roaming around. Like
you need British fascists.
Right, of course you do. It's like the same, and it even extends to the settings. Like, what planets does this take place on? Desert planet? Forest planet? Ice planet? I mean, that's, I think, one part where J.J. Abrams' more or less complete lack of an original thought in his head really shines through. You know, they couldn't come up with, like, you know,
I didn't think they wanted to.
Well, that's the point. They didn't want to. And that kind of bums me out. Like, I would like to go see a Star Wars movie and see something I haven't seen before, even though it's Star Wars, you know, and it's not like, you know, I get it. Maybe
we get the temple in the water in the end. So
that's true, I guess. Yeah, it's like an island. I don't know. But generally, it's really a throwback in a lot of ways. You know, again, nothing that really bothered me in the moment or took me out of the movie. But, you know, just it's just something to point to and say, like, well, they could have tried a little harder or taken a few more risks.
Okay, so I want to formally retread my point about Finn. You are right. He is a protagonist, so I acknowledge this and recant my error. Mm-hmm. And I want to take this moment to talk a little bit about Starkiller Base.
Yes, I was hoping you would.
And why I think it really doesn't work. And this is, as I wrote in my review, this is what keeps the movie from going into A territory, you know, where you say it's a very good movie. Mm. Because the whole Starkiller plot simply has no resonance.
Yeah.
And no one I have talked to about the movie has told me otherwise. They're all saying, it's there. And then they talk about the cool stuff, you know?
Yep.
And I thought about why this is. And I think it is strange because Starkiller Base is really the only major fuck up that they did in their retread of Star Wars 1.
Yeah.
So, not episode 1, of course, but the first movie. So, why did the Death Star work? Was a question I asked myself. And the answer I came up with, because we still didn't know about the Republic back then and we never heard about Alderaan before they blow it up, not in a manner that we could build any connection. So I didn't even know what they blew up in the movie. I still don't know. It is just stuff, and it explodes. And everyone is looking heart-stricken for a second, and then they're going on business as usual. I think the thing that was lacking is an emotional connection. Because in the first movie, it is not Alderaan they are blowing up and some headquarters or stuff. It is Leia's home planet. That is why it matters.
Right.
And then in the end, of course, now the Death Star is firmly established as a menacing presence that kills. The danger for the Rebel base is clearly there.
Mm-hmm.
But in Force Awakens, they destroy something I have never seen before that will never be referenced again. And I don't know anything about it. I didn't even understand, was this in the same system? Does Starkiller Base move? And I don't expect to get any details about this, you know, like, oh, it can move at 1.3 light speed or whatever. But I didn't really know anything about it. It had no place in the universe. It was just coming out of left field. And it didn't really click with me at any point during this plot. I think they would have been much better served had they simply kept it to that big Star Destroyer thing that they started on and devised some mission for the pilots to fly. You know, like, we have to disable all the cannons while they are on board, but we can't destroy it or something like that, you know?
Right.
There would have been something to give Poe to do. And that would have been better and smaller, because how are they going to top Starkiller Base?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's... I have some thoughts about that that I can get to.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I don't want to interrupt your Starkiller rant, so if you got more, go for it.
No, really.
Okay. Yes, I had many of these same problems with you. And you can... There are a lot of ways reasons why it doesn't work as well as the Death Star, both in A New Hope and even in Return of the Jedi. First of all, this is your third fucking Death Star. This is the third Death Star, for all intents and purposes. Like, you've already done it not once, but twice. At this point, diminishing returns are really setting in. It is introduced into the film out of nowhere. Like, there's no talk of this base until all of a sudden you're fucking on it, and there's a Nuremberg rally, and then it blows up whatever planets those are. So the MacGuffin, the map to Luke Skywalker, it has nothing to do with this, whereas in A New Hope, the whole point of the film was like, R2-D2 has the plans, Darth Vader's like, where are the plans? You know, they have to get the plans back to Alderaan, then they have to do this and that. It was established from the very beginning that the base was important. Here it just, like, boom. And it's like, oh, I guess they should worry about that. Also, it raises the question, how did nobody know that they had built a planet-sized weapon until it was fired? You know? Like, how do you even get those resources? It's really not clear. And then, like you said, there's all these, like, does it move from system to system? Does it drain a different star every time? If it does, how does it keep, like, fucking snow on the surface of the planet?
It's all very strange.
Right. You know, some of this you can get I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No problem. Adam Verthead did a FAQ about the movie in which he explained some of these questions, since there seem to be answers out there. So no, it's using the same star every time, but you wouldn't know from the movie.
No, you wouldn't know from the movie. And that's... I'm sorry.
just one additional thought, because there is one more scene that you, which you in passing just mentioned, that throws at the same problem, and that is R2-D2. Starkiller Base and R2-D2 in the movie are two instances in the plot where I think you aren't able to understand what those are if you never watched the originals.
Yeah.
It is especially true with R2-D2. He is simply out of nowhere. You are clearly supposed to know who he is. There is no explanation whatsoever. You are supposed to know. And the same is true about Starkiller Base. You are supposed to know this is a big Death Star.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the necessary legwork is missing. They are simply assuming that you know.
Right. Right.
That is a really interesting structure-wise, and I think we will get back to that.
Yeah.
But now, your turn.
Right, okay. So, let me see. Additional complaints here. Okay, what does it blow up? You're right. There's no emotional connection to it because it's not directly connected to any of our characters. It seems to be Coruscant. It's the seat, you know, they're blowing up the seat of the Republic and everything.
Yeah, but it isn't. It isn't Coruscant. That has been established by now. Also.
Really?
Yeah, it isn't Coruscant. Because the Republic voted to move their capital all the time or something like that. But it isn't Coruscant. It's simply some bag-ass planet that we never heard about.
That's even stupider. Because I was going to complain.
I don't get it.
I was going to complain that, you know, the films are so scared. The film is so scared of the prequels, of invoking the dreaded prequels in any way, that they're going to blow up a hugely important planet and not even mention it by name. That was irritating. Like, I had a friend of mine saying, like, in a way, this was like the new movies blowing up the prequels. Now, if it turns out that's not Coruscant at all, in a way, that's even dumber. Like, that's really, like, what do we even care? And this leads to... No, all right. First, I'll do the one thing that I thought did maybe kind of work about Starkiller Base, which is that it ups the level of nihilistic, insane violence by the bad side, the dark side, really substantially. Like, this screeching asshole Hux and his, you know, and his goth bad Jedi buddy who hates his mom and dad are so pissed off at everything that they're gonna, like, drain a sun to blow up multiple planets at once from, you know, from a distance. Like, that's nuts. And I do appreciate that. And it kind of reminded me to get back to our beloved Nazi Germany about, you know, there was, you know, there's a passage in Ian Kershaw's biography of Hitler where they talk about how Hitler, towards the end of the war, really pinned a lot of his hopes, or said he was doing so, on these wonder weapons that were going to, these technological marvels that were going to change the course of the war. And, you know, it brought up in passing that, you know, some scientists had been like, well, you know, you could split the atom and create like an atom bomb. And he just didn't think it would be practicable in the time frame required. So he didn't, you know, put much effort into that. And Kershaw was like, and thank Christ, because he absolutely, positively would have nuked London and Moscow, like, without any hesitation whatsoever. Yeah. And that's basically... Which is totally true. And it's basically the level of, you know, berserk violence that you're now seeing on the part of the First Order. That I thought worked. The final complaint that I have, it's very specific. The attack run sucked. When they attacked it, again, it was you know, like all these other things on a plot level, it was doing on a physical level. There was no clear physical stakes of what needed to happen at any time. They, you know, normally the way these fights work in Star Wars is the ships start at point A, they gotta get to point B to do thing X in order to affect goal Y. Here, they instantly show up exactly where they need to. Within 30 seconds, they've all hit the target. And then they're like, oh, didn't do any damage. Yeah, we gotta go, we gotta keep doing it. Okay. And then they kind of fly around chaotically. And, you know, and then they manage to do it when the story requires them to do it, and they leave. There's, like, no... As an action sequence, it fails. And I think that's really because it's so poorly defined. Like, when you watch the attack run on the first Death Star in A New Hope, that is a fucking marvel of editing, of pacing, of clarity, of the use of music and sound and silence, and cross-cutting from setting to setting, from ship to ship, from good guys to bad guys, from main characters to... it is masterful. And this was like nothing by comparison. And in a weird way, a lot of Abrams' strengths as an action director, which I don't think he's really that proficient, but all the stuff that's like planet side, where you have TIE fighters zooming through the atmosphere, like shooting at people on the ground, well, there the physical stakes are really clear. These people just have to get away as quickly as possible on foot. And that's how you get a sense of investment and stakes in what's happening. Or the fight where they're chasing the Falcon. Like, she has to learn how to pilot the Falcon. And
it's really good.
Right. And she has a clear physical goal. She's going to get to the Death Star, the Star Destroyer ruins. She's going to fly through it. There's all the physical stakes. You can understand what they're trying to do. you know, but it betrayed him for this attack run because there was just nothing palpable about it.
Yeah, Starkiller Base. It is simply the problem with Starkiller Base from start to finish. It didn't work.
Yeah.
But you just mentioned something in passing. It is interesting, I find, that the movie is, on the one hand, darker than all the other Star Wars movies because the violence is so much more pronounced. But at the same time, it's also lighter because there is so much humor and the characters are having fun blasting things. And I thought this was a really interesting combination.
Totally, totally. It was, you know, I went back and watched A New Hope, and A New Hope has a lot of funny lines in it. And, you know, I think that, you know, I mean, the scene where they go into the detention center and Han Solo has to use the you know, the communication thing, because someone's like, what the hell happened? He is so funny in that. We're all fine now, thank you. How are you? And then he winces because he realizes how stupid he sounds. That's great. And, you know, and this movie is just basically like that all the time. And the one complaint that I think really sticks with the prequels, which I at this point feel pretty strongly in favor of as films, is that they're not funny. You know, even when he tries to be funny, it's very rare for a joke to actually land, and that's a real bummer. This movie is funny, like genuinely laugh out loud funny often.
Yeah.
And, you know, but as you said, at the same time, there's more blood, like, and blood that actually has a meaning, you know, yeah. You know, there's people who are, you know, like, Finn has this kind of, like, you know, he's traumatized by that battle.
Yeah,
it's intense. It's intense, and, you know, I mean, it's not Game of Thrones, but...
No.
Yeah, yeah.
But he doesn't want to be, and I want to go on record for saying I think you are straying far too far down the revisionist lane with the prequels.
Well, I mean,
but that's a topic for another time, I think.
Is it a topic for? I was going to say we can have at that if you want. But
let's push it back a little bit and stick with Force Awakens for the moment. And if we find time, we get back to it. Else, we can do another one about this because it's quite extensive, I think. And lends itself more to Game of Thrones comparisons with Republican politics and trade disputes and whatnot. Huh. So it's become a running joke by now. So, okay, what I wanted to tackle next as a big thing about the movie, and where we also find a larger crossover to Game of Thrones, is the hero's journey. Because by now it's almost a cliche to say that Star Wars is about the hero's journey, because of course it is. But I found it interesting that after the prequels more or less ditched the idea or botched it, depending on your view, but that this is now a retread of it. And I have written in my review that I made three predictions going into the movie, and I had avoided any spoilers about it, so I didn't know anything besides the trailers about what was going to happen. And I said that Rey would be a Jedi, Finn would not be a Jedi, and that Han Solo would die. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing about why Han Solo dies is because he is Obi-Wan in this movie. He is the mentor, and the mentor always has to die.
Yeah.
If it's Eddard or if it's Obi-Wan, whoever is the mentor to our hero needs to die. So this was clear from the beginning, and Star Wars The Force Awakens is very adherent to these rules. It's a very old-fashioned movie, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it is really faithful to this idea of an adventure story with these steps from the hero's journey. And at the same time, Abrams is taking some interesting twists. For example, with the bad guy, we already talked about it, how weird he is and tempted by the light side. And then it's a woman this time, and she doesn't need to be rescued. There are all those variations in it so that you are still excited as a viewer, and you don't know exactly where it goes, but it is familiar enough so you know in what kind of story you are in. And I think this is the main reason why the movie succeeds, other than doing the execution stuff right, like the jokes and the action scenes and the special effects and all that kind of stuff. But the structural reason why it works is that it knows what it is, and it goes through with it in a non-apologetic way that the prequels did not.
I'm not sure how I feel about that. I you know, I guess you're probably right. I would just say that for me, it's the execution that drives the success of the film to whatever extent it actually is a success, much less so than any kind of structural consideration. Because I felt like the fact that it embraced the hero's journey kind of narrative of the original trilogy, that was a fait accompli. Like, you knew the second, A, that Disney bought it, B, that they announced they were going to do a third trilogy set after Jedi, and C, that they hired J.J. Abrams, exactly what kind of movie you were going to get. Which is a big difference than Lucas coming back and making the prequels, and it's about trade disputes and this, you know, this lunatic senator completely owning the entire galaxy behind everybody's nose, like right under everyone's nose. You know, it's a totally different narrative because he already told the hero's journey narrative part of his larger saga.
Yeah.
That was no longer interesting to him.
No, I'm not saying the prequels should have done this. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that they lacked a clear kind of purpose and structure. I mean, we will talk about it in more detail, but you can see what he wanted to do. I'm just arguing it doesn't work. And you can see what Abrams wanted to do, and he succeeds.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. You know, it's funny, the thing that I've seen people say that they're like, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I would have liked to have found out more about the political situation, like you find out in the prequels. And that, to me, was a big flaw in the film. What the hell is going on in this galaxy? Like, if the Republic is the government, who is the resistance resisting?
Well, yes, I thought the same thing. It is entirely unclear.
Right.
But then I told myself, it doesn't matter. Well, and this is kind of a thing with me and my approach to Star Wars. I have actually written a blog post about that 2 or 3 months ago, because I can't take Star Wars seriously.
No.
In terms of world building, because so much of it simply doesn't make any sense at all. And if you start to go into that, like many Star Wars fans do, you know, like technical specs and all that kind of stuff, it is ridiculous because nothing of this has ever been created with a feint of the notion that it should make any sense in the end. Right. It is just an adventure story. So all I need to know is about this specific plot. And the one problem where the being unclear about the political situation hits in Starkiller Base. Always comes back to Starkiller Base because I don't know what they're shooting.
Right.
But this is the only moment in which I need to know this stuff. Had they taken a better target, I don't think this would be such an issue.
Well, no, I've misspoken if I've given the impression that that's the reason that I care about the political situation, that I want to get into, you know, that I'm all of a sudden going to race for the Iron Throne about this, you know, like I don't have that in me. That's not the point. My point is just that both for the original trilogy and the prequels, you can get a sort of gut sense, like a gut level feeling. You can belly feel the landscape, you know, within minutes, you know, you've got a rebellion and you've got like an evil empire in the original trilogy. And in the prequels, you've got like a nice government and you've got shit going on that they don't notice, you know, that's bad coming up. Like that's very easy to grasp. You don't need all the details. And that's not what I'm saying. It's not about the details and the details.
No, not at all.
It's like, I can't, there's no, you can, sure, J.J. Abrams can explain it in an interview. Can have one of these articles that people write, you know, like grabbing things from other sources and putting all this stuff together.
If it isn't in the movie, it doesn't matter.
If it isn't in the movie, it doesn't matter. And even if it's like, you can get away with having it in the movie in a really rudimentary way if it just makes intuitive sense, if you can tell what the relationship is. And it's super, you don't get that. Like on a gut level, like that you can explain in a sentence. It's impossible to figure out. And I think you're right. It comes down to Starkiller Base again. And it's like, where is it? Who's running it? What are they doing with it? Why is the Resistance involved? Why is the Republic involved? Where is the First Order? What is the First Order?
Yes, and why are they so weak? That is so strange. We see from the First Order one Star Destroyer, one squad of TIE fighters, three landing crafts, perhaps 30 stormtroopers, and a planet-sized super cannon.
Maybe that's where all the budget went.
Which makes no sense at all. The scales are so small and all the engagements, but this thing is so absurdly large. I think that is what's ruining everything, really.
You know, I thought about that, and it's like, you know, I just made the joke, which you may not have heard, but it's like maybe that's where all the budget for all the other shit went. You know, it's like, well, I'd love to buy another Star Destroyer, but we really have invested a lot in this weapon the size of an entire planet, so. But it's like, I thought maybe, and this is giving it a hell of a lot of credit, maybe this is some sort of commentary on asymmetrical warfare. Like, maybe this is the Republican wet dream about a suitcase nuke, or, you know, Iran getting its nuclear bomb, or ISIS getting a nuclear bomb, or whatever. And it's like, you know, you've just got this band of fanatics that's small, they're on the outskirts of things, but they're like completely devoted to their cause, and somehow they've gotten this doomsday weapon and they won't hesitate to use it. But that's, I'm doing a whole lot of work on behalf of this film to come up with that, and I shouldn't have to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is the one major flaw. Everything else works more or less like it is supposed to be. You know, without any problems, I would give it an A or a minus, but for this whole Starkiller base and R2-D2 out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, well, that's that.
Yeah, you know, I think it's so funny because it was so difficult for me, like I said earlier, to even articulate what was wrong or what was missing or what I wasn't getting out of it. And now having talked it through, you know, Starkiller Base is representative of like a lot of different minor problems that all kind of coalesce in this one thing, you know, the repetitiveness of the story vis-a-vis the original trilogy.
One too much.
Yeah. The political uncertainty, the lack of a cohesive, you know, just decently directed action sequence there at the end, and so on and so on. It's all, like, in this big, stupid, snowy planet thing.
Yeah, but wasn't it great, the lightsaber battle in the end, how Abrams brought back meaningful lightsaber battles, in which it is not important who is waving what, how long and who, but what emotions and character arcs are expressed in the fighting? I really liked it, especially when you get this gradual leveling up, I suppose, that Rey does in the fight, the quick loss of Finn, then this moment when both reach for Luke's lightsaber and, of course, it flies to Rey. You know, that was just good. I really liked it, and the fight had a physicality to it that was sorely missing from this hopping around that you had in the prequels.
Well,
and a really god-awful fight in A New Hope. So I really thought this was well done.
Yeah, although I will defend the Darth Maul duel at the end of...
The Darth Maul duel is okay, yes.
Till my dying day, I think that's
Attack
one
of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith was really...
Yeah, you know, Sith, the ones in Sith work not as fights, but just as, like, the Emperor is just awful. You know, like, he's just hacking away at people. It doesn't, you know, the choreography isn't there, although, you know, I think kind of the emotional content is there with him and Yoda, or with him and Mace Windu. And this has the combination where it's, you know, I mean, it's choreography, it's not like, it's not Kill Bill, it's not even a Darth Maul thing, but it works, and then there's also the emotional component.
Oh, by the way, you know what, in my head canon, we haven't talked about the bad guy yet, the ultimate bad guy, you know?
Oh, yeah.
In my head canon, there is a game going on at First Order, and this is some officer is telling everyone to hail the Supreme Leader Snoke, and whoever chuckles gets killed. Because, I mean, seriously, Supreme Leader Snoke? Who came up with that name?
Yeah, it's like the scene in Life of Brian.
Always, if you chuckle, you get force choked.
Yes.
All hail Supreme Leader Snoke. You're dead.
Oh, that's I will say for whatever reason, actually hearing people say it, it wasn't as silly as I thought it would be. However, I am
still
However, I am baffled by the decision to make that a CGI character.
Yes, absolutely. I don't understand it yet. Perhaps we will understand it better.
Right.
I actually think it will be a miniature. you know, like 10 centimeters or something.
Yeah.
That guy. But we don't know about anything about him yet. And I'm still not sure whether he should have been in the movie at all. But this will only, we can only answer that question once we have seen the sequel. So I'm putting back judgment on this.
Right. And I absolutely refuse to fucking theorize. I will not do it.
No, not for Star Wars. Sorry, not for Star Wars. It is simply, it doesn't make any sense. The only thing I do theorize about is the one important question, who raised
parents, yeah.
Yes. What's your opinion on it? I would be interested. It's kind of the, who is Jon Snow's mother?
Yeah, question. Making my usual stipulation when I put issue theories, which is that I truly do not care if I'm right or wrong. I assume she's Luke's daughter and they're cousins, not brother and sister.
Okay.
Her and Kylo Ren. That's all I got. What do you think? Okay.
I think she's Han and Leia's daughter, and they are brother and sister. I don't think there are legitimate other options. That's one of the problems with Star Wars. There are so few characters, there really aren't that many options.
Right. But that's so, to me, that's what makes the theorizing so stupid. Like, you're seeing hoof prints and being like, it's a zebra. Like, no, it's a fucking horse. You know, these movies are not, they're not trying to fool anybody.
Yeah. The thing is, the movie deliberately leaves it open because in the first half of the movie, she's clearly Han's daughter. You know, ending sentences with him, instinctively flying the Falcon, repairing the Falcon. It's all Han. And in the second part of the movie, suddenly she's all Luke.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was deliberately left open.
One thing
So we can't make any founded point. You know, there will be no one coming up with a definitive piece of evidence because I don't think they made a movie in a way that allows this.
Right. This reminds me of a funny thing that I saw on Tumblr. It was an interview with the cast, and John Boyega was saying that he'd read a bunch of fan theories that he is Lando Calrissian's son, which to me is like, it's so perfect because it combines two of the most regrettable tendencies in fandom. One, theorizing and making up theories for everything, and two, more or less open racism. You know?
He's the only black character in Star Wars.
So he must be Lando's son. Like, that's, you know, that's pretty funny to me.
It's like Luke Skywalker in the last Star Wars movie deducing that Leia must be his sister. Of course she is. She's the only female
character.
It can't be no one else.
Right. Maybe it's yeah, that's it. That's all you got.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, so, but this, I guess, sums it up basically what we thought about Star Wars. I just want to hearken back once more to the hero's journey because I don't think we ever discussed it in terms of brand story. I don't know whether or not this fits in here, but I think he's the one that is most drawing from the hero's journey from all the characters. Would you agree?
Yeah, but it's complicated by the fact that he's crippled, and so he can't actually have adventures. He's having a hero's journey in his mind, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, of course, it's Martin. He reverts tropes.
Right.
He uses them, but he reverts them.
Which is smart. And I'll be curious to see, since you do have kind of two parallel hero's journeys going on with Finn and Rey, I will be curious to see if they do have the guts to, like, make one of them a bit more complicated than the other.
And especially not a Jedi.
Right. For example, I could see Rey turning to the dark side at some point during the trilogy. Not in the Luke way where he's like, he almost loses it at the very end, but then he doesn't. Like, going full-fledged dark side and then coming back, you know.
Might be, yes.
I mean, again, this is not rise to the level of like, and I'm saying this will happen. And I will come up with justifications for why this will happen. I'm just saying, like, she gains this knowledge and power so quickly that
she's just a bit too strong for her own good.
Right. And Kylo Ren immediately suggests it. You know, no one says anything to Luke about joining the dark side until the end of Empire when things are at their darkest. You know, but here they introduce the idea right away. Meanwhile, Kylo Ren himself is still undergoing training, which is another kind of deviation from the norm.
Yeah. It is interesting. Yeah, really. That is the most thing. I'm interested in how the story will continue, not to the point of making theories, because as I said, I think it's a fruitless effort, because they didn't leave themselves open to that.
Mm-hmm.
But just there are possibilities in there to be entertained, to be even surprised. And I think that's a feat in and of itself.
Yeah.
I am invested in these characters.
Yeah. You know, I just don't want to be over invested. And this is why.
No,
I was, you know, I said on Twitter that I was sort of planning on never commenting publicly about this movie in any way. Part of it
worked for a day.
Part of it was just that I just find the conversations that emerge around these blockbusters so fucking tedious now. You know, like some kind of nerd backlash, and then a backlash to the backlash, and then kind of like this weird late capitalism insistence that, like, if a woman holds a gun in a film, it's a feminist masterwork and it's progressive. And, you know, it's really fucking weird to me and boring and predictable. And I don't really want to weigh in any way. It's just a waste of time. You know, and I'm saying all this as a person with a Rebel Alliance insignia tattoo. You know, I'm not ashamed of being a fan of this shit. I'm just saying the discussion's not all that interesting. Like, there's like, a double-digit number of television shows that I saw in the last year that I liked more than this film, and that I would be, you know, and that I could talk more about, and then have more going on. So that's
Star Wars is for having a good time, you know.
Yes,
you're making a vacation to Star Wars. You're not making it your home.
Perfect. You're having a good time, and even if you're having a bad time, like, just, you know, go with it, because it's kind of interesting and fun to pick apart why things don't work. You don't need to talk about it ruining your childhood, or talk about how horrible it's the end of the world at this, like, cultural monstrosity. Like, you just sound dumb and weird, you know? Just chill out. That's why, you know, I said to my friends on an email thread that we put together just to talk about the movie after all of us had seen it, like, this, that to me was the best discussion that I'd seen of the movie, because nobody felt the need to stake out some position, pro or con, you know, backlash or pushback to the backlash, or, you know, is this movie, you know, some giant leap forward politically, or is it a regression or a way? You know, we're just a bunch of people who went to the movies and wanted to have a good time, and we're talking about it like you would at, like, a diner afterwards, you know, over coffee or something.
Yeah.
And that, to me, and that's what I liked about this podcast, Stefan, is we did the same thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, we did it. That's problem solved.
Let's call it a day.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody, for listening to yet another episode of the Best of Song of Ice and Fire podcast on the internet that is not actually about A Song of Ice and Fire.
Right now, we are really going into every topic that we like. So, but next time, it will be A Song of Ice and Fire related.
Yeah, I think that's a given. And we hope that you will rejoin us at that point.
Bye.
Bye-bye.